Hello. If radio is about planting images in your mind, then Chris McCallum seeded some great images this week. He was reading a script about a time he was acting in a movie in South Africa. He was supposed to ride a horse, but he wasn't really up to it. Something that he couldn't hide when some cattle on set stampeded.
Seeing the cattle advance, my horse turned and ran. And as the cattle gained speed, so did we. It was around this point that I lost my stirrups. It was clear that I wasn't going to stay on the horse, so I didn't. Instead, I toppled over its tail and fell onto a passing cow. The cow, to its credit, neither trampled nor threw me, but chose instead to stop and watch as I hit the ground and lay still. If John Wayne had happened by at this point, his gaze could not have been more withering. "You've let me down," the cow seemed to be saying. "You've let your fellow actors down, but more than anything, you've let yourself down." As I got gingerly to my feet, I saw the rest of the cast and crew, rather than running to my aid, had in fact hurried away in the opposite direction. They were now 3 fields away, and when they saw me rise from the dust, they started to frantically beckon me to join them. "Get over here," one of them shouted. "Get over here now. Run." Puzzled by their concern, I looked over my shoulder to where a small angry cloud had gathered over the field. "Killer bees!" someone shouted helpfully. And I started to run. And as I ran, wondering whether my fear or the bees' rage would prove the more efficient fuel, the bee wrangler arrived. He was a tall, thin white man, wearing flip-flops, jeans, and nothing else. He said not a word, but walked past the crew, and then past me, and then past the angry cloud. He walked to the corner of the field where the bee's nest had been kicked over and picked his way through the debris. He located the queen bee, and holding her gently in his fist, he raised his hand high above his head, and he started to walk. And where he walked, the angry cloud followed. Past me, past the crew, and over to the stump of a long dead tree. The bee wrangler reached into the stump and simply opened his hand and let the queen climb out. And as soon as he stepped away, the rest of the bees flew to her and to their new home. We got most of the footage we needed, but stopped early that day. The director said the camera had been damaged, while the cameraman said that he had lost the quality of light he needed. In truth, though, I knew we'd stopped because there was nothing we could film that day which could match the wonder of the bee wrangler's arrival. And watching the finished film 6 months later in a Soho screening room, I realised we were right.
Chris McCallum from Sunday Miscellany about his time as an actor in a movie in South Africa. Although, according to one of Ray Darcy's listeners, I shouldn't say movie.
Valas Benoit says, how about keeping it Irish and using the word film instead of movie? Don't you want your children to use that word? Keeping the Irishisms alive. Yeah, I'd prefer to say film, Val, or film, as you say down in Kildare. But movie creeps in, doesn't it? And you find yourself saying movie. I worry, actually, about the future because you have very little young people's television on anymore and children aren't being exposed to Irishisms. Like some eejit like myself and Dustin and Zig and Zag on daily and talking, you know, like Irish people talk.
Ray Darcy. And according to Terence Dolan, expert on Hiberno-English, Ray is right.
Some people want to be international, and that's why the Dublin 4 dot accent is now becoming international, because people
is
are
it?
Feeling... Oh, very much so, yes, because people are now beginning to feel, well, throughout Ireland and elsewhere, Irish people now are trying to speak in that way in order to signal that they are from, not necessarily from Dublin, that from a part of Ireland which is successful.
And in this programme, examples were chosen from the archives to prompt Terence Dolan's reading, as it were, of various Irish voices.
84 years ago I was born here, never left it since. There was 4 or 5 in every house, and 7, 8, 9 and 10.
Where was he from?
That sounded Kerry to me.
Yes, yeah,
and he
Kerry.
Said Boran. So there you see, rather than Born, he said Born. Now, would you say Born or Boran?
Born.
Born. So he was the closer to the Irish language than you were, because the R and other vowel consonants in Irish would have what's known as, if I can be pretentious now, an epenthetic vowel. So
wow.
We say elum and colum and ferum.
And philum.
And philum.
Which drives people nuts.
Which it shouldn't, because it's simply a restoration of the Irish means of linking an L and an M, because you can't go in Irish, it has to be lum. Because what is very interesting is that most language change, when it's deliberate, is driven by young women, because young women always have a greater sense of fashion in every way than the young male. And what's fascinating is surveys have shown that when a husband and wife get married, and maybe they're not very well off, as they move up the social scale through getting wealthier, the husband's accent remains the same, whereas the wife's accent gets grander and grander and grander, and she passes, of course, that accent on to the children.
Mm. And this is an accusation, basically, that women are more superficial.
Not superficial, no, more attentive to trying to better oneself. That's what it is.
Is that what it is?
Of course it is, because if you're sitting in front of someone and they're speaking, I mean, I'd be delighted to have someone opposite me speaking with a pure Dublin accent, Limerick accents, but other people who wouldn't, shall we say, have the sensitivity someone like me has to accent would say, well, this one can't pronounce this vowel right. They say but, they say won, they say things like this, and therefore they can't be as intelligent as someone who come in saying, oh no.
Terence Dolan on John Bowman's archive programme. And Terence Dolan died in April this year, a man who introduced a whole generation of radio listeners to linguistics. He was talking to Marion Finucane there. And Marion, on her own show, had author Pat McCabe on. He was part of a rich parade of creative people on Radio 1, Lyric FM and RTE 2XM this week, talking about how they make their work. Sugar. First, Pat McCabe with Marion Finucane. He wrote Butcher Boy, featuring the young Francie Brady, and he's now followed it up with The Big Yarrow. Pat told Marion Finucane that when he's writing, he plays various songs over and over.
At the moment when that song catches fire, it's kind of transcendent almost, and it's like a hymn to human happiness.
Well, it's interesting that it's a hymn to human happiness, because if you take Francie Brady, committed at least one terrible murder, yet you find a place for humour and compassion, and it appears to be important to you to put him in a context that draws us to him.
Mm. It's always kind of difficult when people say, you choose to do this, or you appear to, you know. I think it was Richard Ford might have said, you know, he didn't understand that kind of view, that his characters were galley slaves, that they did what he told them. Well, I would be too afraid to order anyone around. So I kind of hope that somewhere, again, when you kind of surrender, as you do in the great religions of the world, for example, everyone goes down on their knees to submits to a higher authority. And by doing that, sometimes you release a calm, maybe, are certainly a meditative thing which allows you access to aspects of your back brain or your inner soul. But that's what it's sort of always seemed to me when one is writing, why I always write longhand. I think it flows through.
Do you?
Well, it kind of flows through the veins really better for me.
The author, Pat McCabe, with Marion Finucane. Then on Sunday evening on Lyric FM, the musician Gavin Friday of the Virgin Prunes spoke to John Kelly about his youth growing up with the artist Googie and the singer Bono. He told how he had started wearing dresses when he was a teenager.
You know, I was bullied a lot at school. I was put down, tortured, basically, because, like, well, I decided to get my ears pierced and I decided I liked David Bowie. And it was quite a threatening thing to embrace glam rock visually back then. So I don't know where I had this bravado from. It wasn't from my dad. My mum embraced it. She'd take the trousers in and sew the sucking sequins onto the jacket or whatever. So I had a really, really tough time as a kid. And when punk happened, I thought that David Bowie went to this university in the heavens of genius. And then punk happened, and it said, you can start a band. You can do it yourself, make it up. And I went, okay. And I says, and you call me a puff? Well, wait till I get the Virgin Prunes going.
Yeah.
I'll show you what a dress is. I'll show you what a man is. I'll show you what religion is.
Yeah.
I'll show you. I'll basically kill you.
Somebody said to me once, said it was very tough to wear a dress in Ballymun when, in those days when you were a fella.
It was really tough. And I didn't wear a dress like Boy George.
Oh, I know.
This was very much, is he going to kill me or kiss me?
Yeah.
But I remember, like, I'd meet at the end at the bus stop, and Bono and Googie says, oh, Jesus, don't wear the dress tonight, Gav. We just want to go out and have a good time at the gig. I said, I'm wearing the dress. Don't tell me what to do. I says, well, then we're going in for a fun fight. And it just happened. Bam, 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 on the bus. Because... It was just. I grew up with that don't tell me what to do thing.
Did you consider yourself a provocateur? I mean, were you looking for trouble?
I was hurt. Yeah. And I was angry. And from being, believe it or not, I was a very shy young person. And I think just something clicked when I was about 16. And you're just fed up of being hit and being bullied. And I went, no. Okay. I'm going to get you back with a hammer called the Virgin Prunes.
Gavin Friday. He brought in some music for John Kelly to play, David Bowie, for example, and Virgin Prunes' own tracks, but his opening choice was a surprise.
Gavin, John McCormick, before we get into the Virgin Prunes and all the rest of it,
yeah.
Where did McCormick come from in your life?
Well, I grew up in a household. My dad actually professed till the day he died that he didn't like music. I tried telling him that, Dad, even plants like music. But he professed he didn't like music. So there was never a record player till I went out and bought one when I was around 11 or 12. Yeah. But I had the blessed to have an uncle, Paddy Hanvey, who was my godfather, who was the eccentric guy who went and joined the army, came back in the 60s from London with a harlot with dark hair, red lips and tight dresses.
Used the word harlot very casually there.
Yeah, that's how they called her, because she was sort of snazzy and sexy, actually. Yeah. Quite cool. But Paddy was sort of a jazzer and a loner. And I was his godson, but he would bring me on a Sunday to art galleries, and I'd have a bag of crisps and a bottle of Coke afterwards in a pub, Madigan's. But he'd also, up in his apartment where he lived in Pierce Street, he'd play music, and the music was John McCormick and Enrico Caruso. And I wasn't running out buying them, but it planted a real seed.
Gavin Friday with John Kelly and Lyric FM. That idea of an older person triggering an interest in music appeared in the music documentary The Long Road. In it, Cathal Funge spoke to new Irish singer-songwriters. They played their own music and spoke about it, as well as identifying family connections to their talent. So, Maya Sophia from Galway remembers being introduced to Kate Bush in a rather forceful way.
My mum used to... Whenever me and my sister were, like, fighting on car journeys, she'd put on The Kick Inside, that Kate Bush album, and to, like, just drown us out. And so I hated her. And then something clicked when I was, like, maybe 11 or 12, and it was like, oh, my goodness, this is absolutely incredible. And Wuthering Heights was, like, you know, it's so cheesy and over the top. But I just became obsessed with the way she transferred like a novel and like the atmosphere of this like big 300 page novel into like this like 3 minute pop song, and I think that's an idea that stayed with me.
Maya Sophia. The singer Ain't St. John has an affinity with the Botanic Gardens in Dublin.
My parents met there. My mother grew up around Glasnevin, and my father was studying in the college there. He'd won some scholarship. He was a horticultural scientist, and that's where they met. And I would have spent an awful lot of time there as a small child. And it's all caught up in childhood memories. And I suppose I talk about my father used to squeeze the cheeks of these snapdragon flowers and pretend to make them talk, and I found this brilliant. So I suppose that's where that song came from, you know.
You turned its petals inside out, and nature spoke from out its mouth.
Ain't St. John. And Rachel Lavelle's grandfather is himself a composer.
He called me today. He is learning Sibelius, you know, the computer program. And he's been learning it for about 4 years now. And he's fairly good at it. But he's a perfectionist. And he's also, like, really old. It's amazing that he can do that. But I'm very, like, I'd love to record his music, or we're kind of, like, I'm trying to archive it at the moment. But no one is good enough for him, or, like, I don't know. It's interesting, kind of. I don't know where that perfectionism comes from, but he definitely has held it for a long time.
Ladies and gentlemen and viewers all over Europe, may I welcome you in the name of the Austrian Broadcasting System to the Eurovision Grand Prix contest taking place in the ballroom of the old Imperial Palace of Vienna.
He wrote a song for the Eurovision in 1967. I came second.
May we now invite you to listen to the contestants of all the countries taking part in the song contest 1967.
So at that time, the Eurovision was great. But he's really embarrassed about that song now. You know, I was showing him the comments on it on YouTube, and he was like, who are all these people commenting on it?
They envy me my hills of Clare, the white gulls calling in the soft sea air, so much to lose.
Rachel Lavelle speaking there. And it wasn't just musical promptings these singer-songwriters got from home. Junior brother says his family encouraged all sorts of artistic freedom.
When I was about 10, I think, we got a new washing machine, and it came in this big cardboard box. And instead of throwing it out, I think it was my mum was like, do you want to use this, like, to maybe draw on or something? And I was like, oh, yeah, yeah. And I ended up living in it for a week in the back garden, drawing pictures all over it. And my parents just let me at it. My brother's now wife was first going out with him at the time. And the first thing she saw of her new boyfriend's little brother was he was living in a box out the back of the house with loads of drawings on it. So that's quite a first impression, I think. But I suppose a good example of how I was given free rein very early on, yeah, to just do whatever I wanted, really.
Junior Brother from the Long Road documentary, funded by the BAI for RTE2XM. That's RTE's indie and alternative music station. That documentary also won gold at the IMRO Radio Awards last weekend. As I said, it's a documentary about songwriting, and its opening sets up the topic neatly.
Songwriting has to be the most mysterious of the trades in music.
You're calling us heathens with zero respect for the law.
If I knew where the good songs came from, I'd go there more often.
But we're only songwriters, just writing our
songs. It's like fishing, yeah. You gotta have a very comfortable chair, and you have to be very quiet if you want to catch the big ones.
We write what we live, and we live what we write. Is that wrong?
The songs themselves have a greater understanding of the writer's life than the writer himself.
Nick Cave from the opening of The Long Road on RTE2XM. The opening of the drama this week was equally compelling.
Louis Vierne was a celebrated French organist and composer who is really well known for the unusual circumstances of his death. It happened on an evening in June 1937 in Paris in the Notre Dame Cathedral, where he was the principal organist. Vierne was giving a recital, having already played there 1,750 times. He was almost finished his musical piece and was poised to end with two improvisations. He activated the stops he would use for the final section of the performance. Then he lurched forward so his foot came to rest on the low E pedal of the organ. At that moment, as a single bass note boomed out over the expectant audience, the celebrated musician passed away.
Kate Strain from the Department of Ultimology, a radio drama essay that explored the notion of endings.
Was the ending when the musician lost consciousness? Was it as realization spread through the audience that the long-held note was not intentional? Was it when his foot finally was taken from the organ's pedal? Perhaps it came much, much earlier, when Vierne played his final fully intentional note as he finished the main section of the recital. Or maybe it was later, when everybody left and the cathedral fell silent except for the faintest imperceptible resonances of the concert's final note and the audience's shock and concerns.
From this week's Drama on One, the Department of Ultimology.
I like the way you talk, I like the things you wear. I want your number tattooed on my arm in ink, I swear. Cause when the morning comes, I know you won't be there. Every time I turn around, you disappear. Somewhere warm, you know, j'adore la mer. Cause when the morning comes, I know you won't be there. Every time I turn around, you disappear. I like the things you wear. I want your number tattooed on my arm in ink, I swear. Cause when the morning comes, I know you won't be there. But every time I turn around, you disappear.
Niall Horan with his latest single, Nice to Meet You, from The Tracy Clifford Show on 2FM.
And if only I could hold you, you'd keep my head from going under.
Shay Byrne and Rising Time on Radio 1 also had chart music on his show in a nuggety little section just before 6:30.
That's Mr. Lewis Capaldi, and that's called Bruises, and there's various versions of that out there. There's a dance remix, actually the dance remix. Starts, you know it's a dance remix straight away because it starts.
Counting days since my
love same song.
Lost on me.
So I quite like it. And then there's a guitar acoustic version.
Counting days, counting.
Then we heard the live orchestral version, and then there's a recorded version with the normal band. Put it out there, someone's going to like all of them. That was the orchestral version that we heard.
Then Shay referred to the whole Colleen Rooney, Rebecca Vardy online row.
A chap called Colin Power tweeted, just heard John Halligan TD has offered to travel to the UK to chair peace talks between Colleen Rooney and Rebecca Vardy. And then John Halligan tweeted back, I'll take my chances with Kim Jong-un.
From Rising Time on Radio 1, a couple of more shorter moments from the week's radio. Cian McCormack got a tour around the newly refurbished Leinster House, where they got a couple of surprises when they lifted the floorboards upstairs.
We're on the very top floor, which would have been the bedroom area originally. When we lifted the floorboards, we found seashells for soundproofing, which was an old tradition, but we hadn't seen it in Ireland before. It had been used in Britain and other countries with a coastline. But then we also found children's toys that had fallen into the floor. So we had a spinning top, we had a painted toy soldier, we had a musical flute, and a number of other items, tickets, newspapers of the time. So all of that will be on display in the near future.
Kieran O'Connor from the Office of Public Works with Cian McCormack on Morning Ireland.
Chimich puesta baga mui hig sugru.
Then Radio na Gaeltachta played a young singer from 1969. The following year, she was to be part of a band that would gain worldwide fame. Here she is singing a translation of a Joni Mitchell song, The Circle Game.
Is chin she rohi ni sa shi san trej. Rocky amon rocky ek shir hasu agus rocky amon.
The singer is Maya Brennan, and she went on to join Clonard, and at this point she's 17 years of age.
Ig mioru yn y bliant ac o lefan. Sys contes yn y bliant a fos le caiw. San pwest y bag i sgargw meisie mw. Then she surreed all heart is heart is the canig mat is canig chart. Bera hantilix guabulish jan shu. Nine dun ronch ni glinda la gul arash gojo. Adal heart is heart is heart, adis vemich bio. Adal heart is heart, adis vemich bio.
Moya Brennan in 1969 singing Joni Mitchell. That was played on Ian Lee's programme on Shulach Scalach, Air Radio na Gaeltachta. And Moya Brennan will receive a Lifetime Achievement Award at the RTE Radio 1 Folk Awards at the end of the month. And then, on Lyric FM, Marty Whelan was reading texts from listeners reacting to the Brendan Grace documentary on RTE TV the night before.
My brother Michael died the same day as Brendan. July 18th, says Brian and Claire. He was equally corpulent, and as we brought him into his house to be waked, a friend told Brendan's joke about the talking weighing scales. As Brendan stood on the scales, the scale shouted, "Easy, one at a time."
Marty Whelan from Lyric FM. This was, of course, Budget Week, and the week actually started back last Saturday lunchtime, with Cormac O'Hara taking calls on suggestions for Pascal Donoghue.
Dr. Matthew O'Toole, who's the GP. What's your suggestion, Matt?
Yeah, so the Libra, so my suggestion is a very simple one. It's for funding to allow GPs refer public patients for private radiology scans, so MRIs and CTs. So just to put this into context, at the moment in Ireland, GPs actually can't order CT scans or MRIs for public patients. They can only be ordered by hospital consultants. So what that means is that basically if I have a public patient who, for example, needs an MRI of their hip, they firstly have to be referred to a consultant in a public hospital. They have to wait generally years to see that consultant who then books the MRI scan. So first they have to wait on a waiting to see the consultant, and then the consultant books the scan, and they wait on a second waiting list for that MRI scan. In the case of a patient then who then has private health insurance, I as a GP can order an MRI scan or a CT privately and generally get it within days. So providing funding for GPs to allow direct access for private radiology for public patients would actually save the state a lot of money and reduce waiting lists.
Dr. Matthew O'Toole from Saturday with Cormac O'Hara with his suggestion for Minister Pascal Donoghue's budget speech on Tuesday.
Minister, you have 1 hour.
Ciam Corla, this is a budget without precedent. In bringing it to this House, we seek to manage risk for our nation while aiming to make progress on so much. From the health of our national finances to the quality of our public services and to the great challenge of climate change. But these are also times without precedent. And as we respond, we do so with the resources of a well-run economy and the purpose and certainty of good government and responsible politics.
Minister Pascal Donoghue from the Dáil. The reaction to the speech had plenty of vim. This is financial analyst Jill Kirby on the late debate on the proposals to extend medical cards to over 70s.
We're talking about giving medical cards to single over 70s retirees who have incomes of nearly 29,000 a year and nearly 57,000 euros a year for couples. Medical cards for these people, they all, believe me, they've all got private health insurance, and they've got really good private health insurance, and they're not going to give up their private health insurance because suddenly they've got full medical cards. They have GP cards automatically. Every over 70 has a GP card. So I think tonight, the people who are probably really happy with that announcement are probably the heads of the private health insurance companies, hoping that some of them will give up their health insurance because they're very expensive members of health insurance companies. I mean, it's really a nonsense.
Jill Kirby. Also in late debate, Green Party leader Eamon Ryan reacted to the climate emergency measures in the budget.
There are some measures, the introduction and increase in the carbon price, but as one, and it's spent in kind of small little dribs and drabs in kind of, you know, 9 million on cycling, 3 million on agro environment funds. The Department of Agriculture will spend more next year on office equipment than they will on that fund. That's the symbol, in my mind, of kind of, it's tokenistic. And the problem is that to get public with us, and we do need to have public with us, is particularly when you're raising carbon tax, you need to be at the same time putting in the other piece of the jigsaw in place so that it's easier for people to do the right thing rather than all pointing the finger at the people. You have to change your car, you have to change your windows, you have to change your whatever. That's not the way to do it. The way to do it is both to put a price on carbon, but also then really scale up the responses. If we're serious, I mean, the Extinction Rebellion are outside here to this evening and beyond in Merrion Square, and they're saying the response has to be commensurate with the crisis. If to tell the truth, there's nothing in this budget today that actually is a commensurate response. It's scale.
Eamon Ryan. Also on the climate emergency, Fianna Fáil's Stephen Donnelly introduced us to the new word of the week.
This awful word, hypothecation.
Sorry, right? Hypothecation?
That's what it's called. Ring fencing, essentially. I've huge time for Eamon and his knowledge on environmental policies. On this, I just think he's wrong. It's a bit like the idea of Irish water, where we were going to charge people for water and then we were going to send them back a cheque. This tax will raise about 90 million next year. And that 90 million, instead of going back to people in a cheque to be used for God knows what, is going to be ring-fenced for environmental measures. Where I would also respectfully disagree with Eamon is that the carbon tax isn't enough. There's a very clear signal that it's going to go up to 80 euro a tonne by 2030. That is supported, I think, across the board. And I think with that sort of signal, it says, look, we're going to bring it in at a level that doesn't push people into serious distress trying to adjust it. But if we're going up to 80 euro, it means we all have to start doing things differently. Okay. And that has to be welcome.
Stephen Donnelly from the late debate on the night of the budget. And Taoiseach Leo Varadkar had his own version of electoral mathematics following the budget.
You know, in politics, when half the people are saying you didn't do enough and half the people are saying you did too much, you probably got it about right.
Taoiseach Leo Varadkar from Morning Ireland. Actually, Morning Ireland had a trio of solid reporters this week filling us in without fuss or fanfare. Tony Connolly, Sean Whelan and Anne Lucy. In all the toing and froing about Brexit, Tony Connolly in Brussels and Sean Whelan in London condensed the latest news nicely for us.
Well, the talks are continuing this week, but they're really technical talks and they're not negotiations in the proper sense of the word. In other words, both sides aren't chipping away at a text, trying to fashion it into something that they can both live with. And essentially what's been happening in these talks is that the EU side have simply been asking UK negotiators, how is this going to work? What exactly are you hoping to achieve with these ideas? And how are they going to be compatible with the objectives of the backstop, which is no hard border? And how are they going to be compatible with EU law? Because there are still many, many questions about how that's going to work.
I think the life is draining out of the talks process, and we're now into the full-scale blame game. And that was what that explosive memo sent to the Spectator from person or persons unknown but widely believed to be Dominic Cummings was all about. It was establishing the narrative arc of this blame game that will get us through this period of talks breakdown, European Council, and into the election, which everybody now accepts is inevitable here.
Sean Whelan in London, and before that, Tony Connolly in Brussels, and then in the same fashion, Anne Lucy in Kerry came on. She came on to talk about a local story, a Bord Pleanála hearing into the compulsory purchase of land to create a new cycling and walking greenway in the south of the county.
We have 40 individual objectors, and you have a total of 197 landowners, and their objections are twofold. One, they object to a compulsory purchase order, And secondly, they also have concerns about the design of the route in places. So what you're talking about is 222 pieces of land, and they measure between tiny 0.001 hectare to over 0.2 hectare.
All very straightforward, but then the next day, Anne came on the News at One with the latest from the Greenway hearing, and some of what she said sounded so trippy that Claire Byrne seemed lost for words. The issue was about saving an endangered slug using yogurt and a paintbrush.
They will have to move the slug from these two areas, and I think the plan, as far as I can make out from this morning's questioning of the ecologist, is to reintroduce him to the Drumhill area. And in there's initially there was a suggestion that the rocks would all be painted in yogurt. Now, this has been described as a novel approach to protect and ensure the continuation of the slug. What happens apparently is that the yogurt brings lichen back onto rocks and the slug will thrive in this area. So your two ecologists for the council giving evidence, one is Mairead Kelly and the second person is Patrick Ryan, and he was saying that the yogurt painting of the rocks has now approval from the National Parks and Wildlife Service.
Okay, Anne, thank you very much for that. Anne Lucy there reporting from Tralee.
What more could Claire Byrne have said from the News at One? The radio fizzed with energy on Saturday night with a concert from Glor in Ennis to celebrate the show Sruna Mhéile. Sruna Mhéile means the Straits of Moyle, and this is the stretch of water in the narrowest gap between Ireland and Scotland. It runs between the Mull of Kintyre and the Antrim coast, and the programme is called after this stretch of water because it's an Irish-Scottish co-production that's been going for 25 years. It's a programme broadcast both on Radio na Gaeltachta and the BBC's Radio na Gael. Scottish group Avil on the 25th anniversary concert for Sruna Mhéile on Radio na Gaeltachta on Saturday night. The next day on Radio 1, another anniversary was marked, this time on Sunday Sport.
The game's fast and furious. Very little between the sides as yet. And at half-time, it's Dublin 4, Galway 6.
Yes, 78-year-old Mick Kazan, who won an All-Ireland with Dublin in 1963, dons his club jersey again to wind back the years.
A point for Dublin. Gerry Davies.
Well, Mick, first of all, are you nervous?
A little bit, yeah, I'd have to admit, yeah. This came late, it wasn't scheduled until maybe Wednesday. And I said, OK, I'll come up, and maybe not. And so I said I'll come up, do the warm-up, and see how the game's going. And if it's ding-dong, I might stay on the line. If it's not ding-dong, maybe we'll get in. But it's celebrating the 60th anniversary of captaining an All-Ireland winning team. And if you don't remind people, they won't remind you. So it's the 60th anniversary, and I'm coming out here today to say to people, keep playing football. I'm 78. I still play recreational football, but this is a token appearance with the junior team.
What keeps you going, Mick? What motivates you? Why are you so active?
The O'Neill's football. I love it. I prefer it to the Titleist. I play a lot of golf. But I just love having an O'Neill's ball in my hand and kicking it over the bar, doing a solo run. I play football three times a week, Monday, Wednesday, Saturday. But that's recreational, non-contact. But it's also about promoting that. And for these guys playing today, it's somewhere for them to play in 5 years' time, in 10 years' time, 60 years' time.
78-year-old Mick Kazan togging out for Naomh Maranogue and talking to Pat Costello from Sunday Sport on Sunday. Back to writers and how to overcome blocks in writing. And Ryan Tuberty had Sarah Green on his programme. She used to be a writer on EastEnders and described how she overcame the problem of how to set up a scene.
I sometimes used to hit a bit of a brick wall, and you do because you work very, very, very fast on EastEnders, and it is, you know, the white hot crucible of like, there's the script, it's there, it's on, it's done, it's on the TV and it's gone.
Yes.
And every now and again I would kind of like, I have absolutely no idea how to get into this scene with Peggy and Dot and Phil. And I'd just make it really obscene. It would just be it would just be EastEnders After Dark. Everybody cussing and swearing, you know, terrible thing. You know, like throwing each other up against the fridge and ripping each other's clothes off. And I'd write it like this, and then I'd just press delete, and then I'd.
No, I want to see that episode.
Yeah,
it's kind of like
I've never heard this before.
And at some point in this,
but so this was an exercise to get me writing.
Meat and bones of the scene.
So and in this sort of orgy of deranged filth, someone would say, you know, are you going to go around and see Mark Fowler? And you're like, oh, right, OK.
That's a Mark Fowler scene.
Now Mark Fowler comes in and starts doing all sorts of nonsense. But, yeah, but sometimes he just... I've just got to write something. So it would be like, here, Phil, don't you dare do that. Shut it, Mum, it's a sink, it's what it's for. You know?
Sarah Green, writer in studio with actor Killian Scott on The Ryan Tuberty Show. Sean O'Rourke had a writer from England on his show too, Ian Duig, who reminded us that trolling didn't just start with the internet. Ian has co-written a book about the experience of the Irish in Britain.
When the IRA campaign was on, in Leeds and I guess in other people's areas as well, people would look for Irish names in the telephone directory and phone them up and abuse them. This certainly happened to people that I worked with. You could be harassed in different ways. There was ways of finding out if you were Irish.
Mm-hmm. Writer Ian Duig from Today with Sean O'Rourke. And that programme also dealt with one of the most stunning stories of the week.
Dublin City Council is facing allegations that it advised builders to pay protection money to the head of a drugs gang. The court was told that three firms paid the two criminals a total of just over €553,000, according to the bank account records of the men who received the money. For more, I am joined by Sinn Féin councillor in Ballyferm, Dáithí Doolan.
Dáithí Doolan told Sean O'Rourke that although this story broke this week, he tried to warn the government and Gardaí about it years ago.
Myself and Deputy Angus O'Snoddy sent a very detailed email to the Minister for Justice, the Minister for Housing, Minister Catherine Byrne, the Commissioner, City Council and other stakeholders, outlining in some detail what we believed was going on in Cherry Orchard. It's been proven to be correct. We got no response. And again, I have it in front of me, the 5th of January 2017, urgent situation regards Orchard Lawn site was the heading of the email. Again, we sent it to the ministers, we sent it to the Gardaí, and we're seeking an urgent meeting to discuss what was going on, because it was brought to our attention, and I quote from the email to the ministers, I have been made aware that there had been serious approaches by criminals involved setting out conditions regarding the restart of the works scheduled here for Monday morning. Again, no meeting was ever forthcoming. So I think why were our emails ignored? A councillor, a TD in the area, active on the ground, who worked very, very hard for delivering these housing units for a community that needed housing. And when we drew attention to the fact that there was criminal activity in the area, holding the area to ransom, attempting to block the housing going ahead unless they could control the building sites, we made ministers, Gardaí, aware. And then we got no response. And I think this would not be tolerated in Foxrock or Blackrock. They were swooped in and dealt with it swiftly and appropriately. But I do think, and this needs to be heard, I do think people look down their noses at the fact that it was only Cherry Orchard. And I think that's inexcusable. No. And now, unfortunately, we're reaping a sorry harvest for people choosing to ignore the alarm bells we were ringing back in December 2016. But we have a plan now in place that will develop the whole of Cherry Orchard, hopefully over 2,000 homes, retail units, schools, sports facilities. We didn't want all these sites to be held to ransom by criminal gangs. So we wanted to make sure that the attention was drawn, and we sought an urgent meeting. No meeting was forthcoming. As we also need to remember, one worker nearly lost his life going about trying to build social housing in Cherry Orchard simply because he was doing a day's work. He was doused in petrol, set on fire, in an attempt to block those houses going ahead. That is unacceptable. If any of us were going about our daily jobs and we were attacked like that, they're quite rightly, there'd be uproar. There was silence at the time. And I tried to roar from the rooftops that this was unacceptable. Why was this going ahead? And I was met with a deafening silence.
Dáithí Doolan, councillor from Cherry Orchard, on Today with Sean O'Rourke. The documentary on One this week opened with a piece of audio that should never have been heard on radio.
Friends of Eileen, I hope you realize that this is not going to be easy. But please bear with me.
In mid-December 2016, Jim Kenny took to the altar to deliver a eulogy to his dead wife, Eileen.
Forgive me, my vice is not up to scratch.
Eileen had battled hard against cancer.
She was pretty, smart, kind, loving and compassionate. She was devoted to her family, especially her special needs daughter, with whom she had great empathy.
Jim Kenny's wife Eileen died of cancer. She was being treated for the disease but was unhappy with the care given to her by her original oncologist. She took that oncologist to court and won a compensation payment and an apology from the oncologist for shortcomings in her treatment. Jim and Eileen then reported the oncologist to the medical council. The medical council appointed an independent expert to review Eileen's case, and following a report from that expert, the medical council decided that the oncologist had no case to answer.
The decision was that while the standard of care being given to Eileen by the oncologist was below an acceptable standard, however, they regarded that it wasn't serious. Well, Eileen was, this was in 2016. Unfortunately, her health was deteriorating at this time, and I think it was absolutely disgraceful, insensitive, and insulting to think the way she was treated could be regarded anything but serious.
But Eileen's solicitor discovered that the independent expert hadn't been given all the facts about the lapses in Eileen's treatment. Given that, they asked the medical council to go back and review the case against the oncologist. The medical council refused.
Today, 2 years ago on this date, Eileen passed away. It's still very raw. And I think for us that we've never got the answers. It'll always remain like that until I get answers to what happened to Eileen. And I'll never accept that what happened to her was a trivial affair. I'll never understand how Eileen came to terms with what happened to her. She put up a brave fight. It wasn't a fair one.
Maybe Santa might have brought her one.
Now what? Oh, a big car. Look, Louise, look. What? Why don't you push it down? Look.
From the documentary on One, A Fight to the End. Once more on writing. On Country Time, Brian Lally introduced a singer with an unusual way of working.
One of my favourite people in country music and in music generally is a lady called Mary Gaucher. She's an extraordinary life, an extraordinary singer, and been through the mill, and she's come out the other side. And she's helping people indeed that have been through the mill as well, because she's recently been involved in writing workshops with US veterans. Basically wounded people go off on a retreat, a songwriting retreat, and they come away with 10 or 12 songs. Mary Gaucher's album at the moment is songs that have been all crafted from these writing retreats. And this is a beautiful piece. This is called The War After the War.
Who's gonna care for the ones who care for the ones who went to war? There's landmines in the living room and eggshells on the floor. I lost myself in the shadow of your honor and your pain. You stare out of the window as our dreams go down the drain. Invisible. The war after the war. I get no basic training.
Well, that's Mary Gauthier there. That name again is G-A-U-T-H-I-E-R, Mary Gauthier. And the Rifles and Rosary Beads is the name of her album.
From Country Time with Brian Lally. Just before I go, a couple of more short moments from the week's radio. Ray Darcy committed the ultimate sin at this time of the year. He mentioned Christmas and toys.
We're going to take a break from budget matters now. And what better way to do that than look at the top 10 toys for this Christmas? Frozen 2, Arendelle Castle. You probably didn't even know there was a Frozen 2 if you don't have children of a certain age or grandchildren of a certain age. I don't think it's in the cinemas yet, but the toy is going to be much sought after this year, the castle. €179.99. Another movie, Toy Story 4, which is out during the summer, and the main character from that, Forky. You can get a push and talk Forky, which is number 9 in the must-have list. That's £30.
And I won't inflict any more of that on you. Suffice to say that Ray got upbraided by his listeners.
Should the toy show just be recycled toys? Second-hand toys, sustainable toys, reusable toys. Even Lego has gone green with plastic. End the gross consumerism. Shame on you, Ray, promoting plastic toys. Well, I wasn't promoting them, I was just telling you about them. And you'll have to talk to somebody else about the toy show featuring sustainable toys. But that's, we've been talking about it here on the show for quite some time now. Peak consumerism, it can't continue the way it's going with clothes and toys and everything else. The planet can't sustain that amount of buying. Stop mentioning prices when talking about kids' toys. Young ears are listening.
Sorry. And on Liveline, Joe Duffy dealt with the travails of people dealing with cameras on toll roads.
Ger, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
Now, let's be clear here, Ger. What type of tractor does your husband have?
John Deere.
John Deere. And has it cost him dear at this stage? Because when was he on the M50?
He was never on the M50, Joe, with a tractor.
Because you can't take a tractor onto the M50.
Absolutely.
Unless it's on the back of a low loader. Okay, so we got a bill for his John Deere tractor.
Yes, correct. I didn't recognise when the penalty notice came through.
Yeah.
I was looking at that. When were we on the M50? I didn't pay it. So I looked at it and the vehicle was registered to my husband.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't recognise the registration number of it straight away. And I thought, well, it's not what I drive. Or it's not the vehicle my husband drives. And I said it to my husband, and he said, that's the registration number of the John Deere tractor.
John Deere.
So I rang. Mm-hmm. I rang them, and I told them it was a tractor.
Yeah.
And
does it look like a tractor? The John Deere looks like a tractor. They're pretty identifiable.
It's a tractor. It's a green tractor.
Okay.
So the guy said, I look into it. Mm-hmm. So I didn't hear any more for a couple of weeks and got the penalty notice again. Same reg, same everything. And I just rang them. I said, I've been on to you about this. This is a tractor. So that was the end of that. The bill had gone up. I can't remember exactly how much it was. So weeks later, whatever way they accumulated. Never heard any more. But the registration number was registered to my husband.
Okay.
And as a result, it was a John Deere tractor.
And how did it, was this resolved or have they stopped? Did they must have looked
never
at the...
Never heard.
Yeah, but they'd look at are you presuming they looked at the photograph and they got in forensics and got in forensic photographic companies and they eventually said, no, that is not a tractor, that's a car?
I'd say so, Joe, because, you know, they would pick up a car travelling through the toll with the same reg as a John Deere tractor.
Stay there, Ger. There might be another explanation. But anyway, Colm, what happened?
How you doing, Joe? It was back in 2017, February 2017, I had an accident and my leg, I basically broke my leg. It was in a cast and that. So I was sort of at home and that I couldn't do anything. So I was just checking a few different things. And one of the things I was checking on was my account with EasyTrip.
Okay.
So when I checked it anyway through the bank, a lot of money had been taken out of it. And I got on to EasyTrip and they said, oh, you must be very busy. And I said, no. I said, my leg's in a cast at home. I can't drive. And he said, there must be somebody else driving your car. I said, certainly not.
Yeah.
So anyway, I had done 101 trips, which wow. weren't mine. And this was over a 3-month period.
And how much were they looking for?
Well, it was deducted out, so it was 101.
Oh, it was, it was whipped out. Oh, sorry.
Oh, okay. €2.10 okay. for each trip and that. So this was from March the 7th until June the 13th. Mm-hmm. Now, they told me, in actual fact, I was very lucky because you can only go back 3 months. And had we missed that period, well, then you wouldn't be able to get any refund, but they'd check it out. So anyway, in due course, they did check it out, and they sent me photographs from the M50 of 101 visits by, I was only looking at a photograph of there. It's a sort of a silver and black truck that went through on my reg. You know, now my reg at the time was 08D. The truck was 060, but mm-hmm. the 6 had a little stud in the 6, which made it look like an 8.
Yeah,
but
very good, yeah.
The thing about it was that a truck, I don't know what they pay, it's about €6, so I was just wondering how they couldn't tell the difference between the truck and the car.
From Liveline on Radio 1, so that augurs well for technological solutions to the hard border. That's it for this week. Thank you to those of you who wrote with suggestions of clips I should play to playback@rte.ie. And if you go to the playback page on rte.ie, you'll find a list of all the items in the programme with links to the relevant shows. Until next week, slán.